Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On Sunday evening, Paweł Adamowicz, the mayor of the northern Polish city of Gdańsk, was stabbed in front of thousands of people at a charity concert. He died after 5 hours of surgery. He was 53. Paweł Adamowicz was the mayor of Poland's sixth largest city since 1998. Today's guest, Christian Davies, reports that Adamowicz was a powerful liberal voice in a country that has been governed by the right-wing Law and Justice Party since 2015. Adamowicz is known in Poland and internationally as a staunch supporter of LGBT rights and the rights of migrants and refugees during a period of rising anti-immigrant sentiment. Observers say he was regularly subjected to personal attacks and abuse on social media and from right-wing media outlets. He was killed by a 27-year-old man with a record of violent crime who was released from prison just last month. Joining us to discuss coverage is Christian Davies, a correspondent for The Guardian based in Warsaw, Poland. Christian has written for a number of publications, including Foreign Policy and Politico Europe. Hi, Christian. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thanks so much.
So the fatal stabbing of this very popular mayor has just sent shockwaves throughout Europe. Give us a little background of who he was.
Yes. Well, Paweł Adamowicz is background is very interesting. Like a lot of present generation of Polish politicians, he emerged from the Solidarity movement, which helped to overthrow communism in the 1980s. He was a student leader of Solidarity in Gdańsk in the late 1980s, so he was part of the younger generation. But I think what's very important to stress is that he actually always identified as a conservative politician and as an openly religious man and politician who seemed his Christian values over time, over his long term as being the president of Gdańsk, actually led him to embrace what are often regarded as liberal progressive causes. So Poland is a country which, like a lot of Western countries, is very divided at the moment between kind of political conflict between liberal and conservative world views. And he was someone who actually transcended that, as someone who felt that his that Christian social teachings led him to stand up for LGBT and migrant rights, and not just those things, but those things amongst other things.
And tell us a little bit about the far-right Law and Justice Party, just to give us some context here. Since 2015, that party has been in power, and it's allied itself with other right-wing governments in Hungary and Italy. The Polish government also enjoys close relationships with Donald Trump. So tell us a little bit about this party and how it came to power.
Well, as ever with Poland, you have to go slightly back into history. The power of the Solidarity movement that overthrew the communist state was, well, the clue is in the name. It wasn't just solidarity between workers. It was solidarity between various different social groups, different classes, and different regions of the country, and particularly between the left and the right. I don't mean the left in terms of the communist left, but in terms of liberal, social democratic, pro-European, egalitarian values, and patriotic, often religious, Catholic social teachings, and so on. And that was a united movement which combined all of those different things against a common enemy, which was the communist apparatus. But once Solidarity was victorious, that unity disappeared. And the former Solidarity activists very quickly split, I mean, into, broadly speaking, into two different camps. And the more liberal pro-European perspective, basically won the day over the last 30 years. The free market economy, but also a very liberal constitution, which would be quite familiar for American listeners, defending the equal rights, the rights of minorities, rights of free speech, and so on. Over time, over the last 30 years, Poland has not only had an economic boom, but it's had quite a significant social transformation, where it's become a much more liberal country, and it's changed a lot. And Adamowicz, although he was in many ways relatively conservative, he was part of this pro-European progressive half of the Solidarity movement, which basically ran Poland for a lot of the last 30 years. But the right wing, the conservative, more conservative and more Eurosceptic part of Polish society, was often very unhappy with this transformation. And although I don't want to give a huge long lecture into the whole thing, what essentially happened is Law and Justice, the party in power now, became a vehicle for all the different people who are discontented with Poland's direction over the last 20, 30 years, for various different reasons. Their argument is that the revolution hasn't happened yet, and they're instituting their own revolution, which is in many ways a anti-liberal counter-revolution, which has been quite dramatic. This has led to a very high level of social political polarization in Poland, and a kind of culture war, in a way that many Americans would be familiar with. When Poland changed governments from this liberal pro-European government to this illiberal, anti-liberal counter-revolution, it became a symbol across Europe and indeed the Western world, which was followed by after that by Brexit and by Donald Trump's election in the United States, that somehow something in the West was changing, that there was some kind of counter-revolution happening. And that's why Poland is so interesting for the West more generally, and not just for itself.
And so much drastically changed after this Law and Justice Party took over. In Politico, Maciej Kisielowski, associate professor of law at Central European University in Budapest, write that since this party took over, they instituted a blatantly unconstitutional takeover of Poland's judiciary, the public prosecutor's office, the independent civil service, and its public service broadcasters, which I'll ask you about the media in a minute. He also says that its actions prompted the European Commission to initiate, for the first time in history, the procedure to recognize a clear risk of a serious breach to the democratic rule of law. Talk about the significance of that. And he writes about this because he says there's no possible way they can investigate what happened to him, to this mayor, in a fair way.
Well, the possibility for a fair investigation is very complicated. I mean, that analysis that you read out, I mean, I agree with. I've been reporting on this country for the last 3 years, and so I've watched this process happening. I mean, what you have to understand is this is a government with a very illiberal, and I don't mean liberal in the American sense. I mean illiberal in the sense of it doesn't believe in a separation of powers. It doesn't believe in the judiciary being separated from the executive, or indeed from the legislature. And every independent institution is seen in this perspective as somehow a challenge to the will of the people, as expressed in the election. So any attempt to defend the independence of these institutions is presented as a bureaucracy resisting the will of the people, or judges protecting their privileges, and so on. So what we've had is a very radical campaign of the government to take control of these institutions, which used to be more or less independent. I don't mean they were necessarily always perfectly independent, but we've seen a very radical politicization. In particular, over, as you said, the judiciary and the legal system, the government tried to force the retirement of a significant number of Supreme Court judges through passing a bill in the legislature. The American equivalent would be Congress passing a law to force the retirement of 6 out of the 9 Supreme Court judges, and then saying that President Trump has the right to appoint 6 Supreme Court judges, in other words, to appoint 2/3 of the new Supreme Court because he was elected, and that's just the way it is. They don't pay much attention to the Constitution or any of these checks and balances. So, yes, the judiciary, it's not completely subjected to the ruling party, but it's under a lot of political pressure. The Polish prosecutors and police are also heavily politicized. But also society is very divided. So it's not just the independence in practice of the law enforcement in Poland. It's whether it's perceived to be independent, because we've had such a radical process of politicization. So the even the honest law enforcement officials are going to find it very hard to operate in a very politicized environment. And I think that's the problem.
Today we are speaking with Christian Davies, a correspondent for The Guardian based in Warsaw, Poland, and he has been writing about the killing of Paweł Adamowicz, the mayor of the northern Polish city of Gdańsk. It happened on Sunday evening in front of thousands of people at a charity event. He died after 5 hours of surgery. He was killed by a 27-year-old man with a record of violent crime. We'll talk about this man who killed the mayor in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, Christian, what is the state of the media in Poland, and what changed after the Law and Justice Party came into power a couple of years ago?
Well, it's very interesting. When I speak to people from Western Europe or from North America, and when we have this discussion about the media, it's still often seen in this 20th century Cold War way that that this is about censorship, that you're not allowed to say what you want. But the media environment is very different, and it's a challenge, again, which would be familiar to many Americans. The problem is not necessarily that the government is not allowing opposition to be expressed. The problem is that the society, different parts of society, live in two parallel realities. And the government doesn't need to convince a large segment of the population to support them. All they need is to ensure that their base still remains loyal to them, because they need a certain minimum of votes to hold on to power. So we're in a situation where people live in different realities. And what the government did was they ensured that they... they had their own segment of the media market by taking control of the public media. That meant reforming how public media is appointed. It's directly appointed by the ruling party now. And everyone, any fair-minded person can see, and I think this actually includes some supporters of Law and Justice, that public media has been turned not just into a biased producer of so-called news, but actually is producing very aggressive, very crude propaganda, which even the Russians would be ashamed of. It's very, very unsophisticated. Just to give an example, the nightly news regularly runs headlines like "Poles don't like the opposition." Or the opposition are made up of defenders of pedophiles and alimony dodgers. It's kind of really, really crude stuff. It's not even pretending to be fair. But the point is that people stop watching it. A certain residue of people still watch it and are still influenced by it. But they don't need most of the population to believe them, as long as they have a certain minimum. So this division creates anger amongst a lot of people, aggression on both sides, And the aggression, the bipartisan aggression, forces a lot of people to disengage entirely. And again, I think this is something that's familiar not only to listeners in America, but in Britain we have a similar thing over Brexit, that when you have a lot of aggression and confrontation in public life, a lot of people withdraw. And that suits authoritarian leaders very well, because they don't need people to love them, they just need people not to fight them. And that's an important difference.
So many similarities. One of the residents of Gdansk told you that if you watched our main government TV, you would see for months there were programs about how bad the mayor is, how he lies, how he steals. They created a mood in which weak people, sick people respond to this kind of atmosphere. Can you talk about that? And you also report that no evidence has emerged that the attack was politically motivated, but many in Poland are blaming the stabbing on a more general rise in social tensions and an increasing prevalence of hate speech. You report that even before this stabbing, silent protests had been planned in a number of cities on Monday.
Well, yes. I mean, this is a very subtle and delicate discussion. To break down how this debate is playing out in Poland. What you have is someone who the perpetrator who went on stage and stabbed the mayor. He did it on stage in front of this great big charity concert, which itself the charity has been subjected to this political divisions as well. But he actually had time to grab the microphone and tell the crowd why he says he did it, and he says that he blames Adamowicz's political party, which he was a member of until very recently, for his imprisonment. Now, there are some people who say, well, clearly the political atmosphere of aggression and hatred, particularly aggression directed by right-wing and public media against the opposition, of which Adamowicz is obviously a part as an opposition mayor, played a very important part, whereas the supporters of the government say that their opponents are trying to politicize the actions of a violent criminal who according to some reports had serious mental health issues. Now, there is a middle way, of course, which is wasn't entirely political, but neither can it be separated from the wider context of hate speech and increasing violence. As we know, there is a clear link between hate speech and violence, verbal violence, and real violence. There's been a sharp increase in hate crimes in Poland, and these are both verbal and physical attacks in the last 3 years. Which monitors a link to the change in political atmosphere in the last 3 years. When I reported there was no evidence of political motivation, it depends what you mean by political. I think we haven't yet seen evidence that the attacker was motivated purely from ideological considerations. In other words, he didn't necessarily kill the mayor because the mayor supported LGBT rights, or that he was identified with liberal values, and that the killer was somehow a right wing activist. But whether he was affected by the wider atmosphere is a very delicate and difficult question. But I personally I find it hard to believe that his actions can be separated from the propaganda that has been pumped out at the moment, and I'll explain why. The question is, why would someone who was imprisoned for a violent crime blame a member of a political party? And one of the main claims of government propaganda is that the liberal opposition and the judiciary form a kind of corrupt mafia who act together to protect their own financial and ideological interests against ordinary people. And when the government was trying to campaign to take over the judiciary, to take control, their main argument was that the judges were the servants of the liberal opposition, that they served them. And that appears to be, although I have to be very clear that I'm not saying that, I don't have a special insight, I don't know if this is definitely the case, but it appears to be that this may have been at least one source of motivation. The idea that judges in Poland take their orders from politicians, and specifically from liberal politicians like Adamowicz. So it's a very complicated question. And I think the important thing is to say that this was a problem even before the murder. You know, whether Adamowicz is murdered or not, this was already a really serious issue, and people were already predicting that someone would be killed one day because of this.
Well, we are going to do an entire show about the rise of the right in Europe, and we would love to have you back. Christian, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
Christian Davies is a correspondent for The Guardian based in Warsaw, Poland, and we've been talking about the killing of Paweł Adamowicz, the mayor of the northern Polish city of Gdańsk. He was stabbed on Sunday night in front of thousands of people at a charity concert. He was just 53. He was killed by a 27-year-old man with a record of violent crime. And you could read more about what is happening in Poland at yourcallradio.org. Now we are going to switch gears and talk about media coverage of the massive teacher strike in Los Angeles, which is now on its fifth day. Since Monday, 30,000 teachers in a district of about 350,000 students have been on strike. Joining us to talk about this is Miriam Powell, an award-winning reporter and a New York Times contributing op-ed writer. Her latest piece in the New York Times is called What's Really at Stake in the Los Angeles Teachers Strike. She's also author of The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and shaped a nation. It traces the history of California through four generations of the family of Governors Pat and Jerry Brown. And for listeners who live outside of California, Governor Jerry Brown just stepped down in November. Hi, Miriam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. I really appreciated your piece. I've been listening to so much coverage of the strike, and I really appreciate the fact that you bring in the charter angle and the billionaires that are pushing charter schools. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to ask you, Miriam, what really stands out for you about this strike? I mean, this is massive, the second largest public school district in the country. What stands out for you?
You know, one of the things that stands out for me is the commitment of the members to strike and their sort of enthusiasm about it, which stems, I think, from just sort of a real desperation and frustration that's built for so many years. You know, when they took a strike vote, 98% of the members who voted in favor of going on strike. And strikes are difficult. They're costly for people. They're disruptive. That's a huge show of support for something that is a last-ditch action. And that, sort of sense that there is a sort of movement, and when you look at the pictures and the videos from this week, today is the first day in Los Angeles that it has not been raining, so you've had these thousands of teachers out on the picket lines in the rain. That is quite remarkable, and also the level of support that is evinced by parents in the district. I think there is a sense of people just being sort of so fed up with this situation that has prevailed for so many years in LAUSD, that there is this sense that, you know, this is not a moment, this is a movement, kind of a spirit to it. It's an interesting time. There have also been, it also builds on, of course, the teacher strikes last year in other states in different parts of the country. And in general, there's been a real resurgence in strikes in the last year in this country, which is an interesting development. The other thing I would say kind of on that vein is that there was a major court decision, U.S. Supreme Court decision last year, the Janus case, which was aimed at weakening public employee unions by taking away their ability to automatically have members. There was many years of litigation leading up to this, and there was an assumption that that decision would really hurt the public employee unions, including the teachers. And it's interesting that we see that that has not happened in California, and the membership in UTLA, the teachers union in Los Angeles, has continued very strong. And I think that's an indication of the sort of situation we're in right now, that draws these all of the issues of economic inequality that are so manifest in California, where we are both the richest and the poorest state in many ways, into real dramatic effect.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll continue with Miriam Powell. She's an award-winning reporter, New York Times contributing op-ed writer. Her latest piece, What's Really at Stake in the Los Angeles Teachers Strike? Can California provide sufficient resources to support an effective public education system, or will charter schools cripple it? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, a show that's better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's roundtable, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news with 1A. And then later on tonight, on the media at 6 and 7 o'clock for Left, Right, and Center. Stay with us here on KLW.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are talking about media coverage of the teacher strike in Los Angeles, which is now on its fifth day. I should also add that Oakland teachers have called for a sick out today over contract tops, better pay. I mean, teachers across the country, in a sense, are really fighting for the same things because public education has been gutted in so many parts of the country. We're talking today with Miriam Powell. She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called What's Really at Stake in the Los Angeles Teachers Strike. Miriam, the other thing that really stopped me in my tracks, and you went into this in your piece, is that Los Angeles now educates just under a 500,000 students. More than 80% of these students are living in poverty. And as you said before the break, we are talking about a state. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. It's run by Democrats, home to billionaires and millionaires. And 80% of LA public school children are living in poverty.
By some measures, it's even 85%. And the district also is somewhere between 73 and 77% Latino and about 10% Black. Those are not representative of the population of Los Angeles as a whole. You know, you have a situation where many, many parents who can afford to send their children to private schools do so. And what's left is a very difficult population to educate with these very limited resources. I mean, the current number is that a quarter of the students in the district are English language learners. So, you know, again, a big hurdle, and we're talking about a population that also desperately needs quality education in order to move out of the economic circumstances that they're in. So there's been a really, you know, a carving out of the district and an abandonment in many ways, I think, by the people in Los Angeles who could afford to pay more for schools or to be more, you know, there's a disinvestment in the schools that's been going on for many, many years. And this is just sort of the first time it's erupted in public view. And I think that's another important piece of the strike, is that it has really forced a lot of people to see what is happening in a situation that they could have until now, you know, very easily avoided and just ignored. LA is so big, it's massive, it's split in so many different ways and segregated in so many different ways by class and by race, that it's very easy for a lot of people in Los Angeles to not pay any attention to the situation in the school district. And yet, you know, I think the strike is trying to say that, that to appeal to the general public, not just those people who have children directly in the school system, to say that education is a public good and that there should be some greater investment in it.
The other thing I appreciated about your op-ed is you provide some historical context. You write about Proposition 13, which really crippled school districts' ability to raise funds. This is the sweeping tax measure that passed in June 1978. Can you talk a bit about Prop 13 and how it has affected schools in California, specifically Los Angeles?
Sure. I mean, it's had the same impact everywhere in many ways, and it coincided also with a very major court decision that ruled that the old system of financing schools through property taxes was inequitable. You know, in the old days, school districts could set their own tax rates, and so that enabled districts that had high worth, you know, high property values to raise more money with lower tax rates compared to poorer districts. So that sort of fight over education equity was building at the same time as Prop 13. And then Prop 13 came along, which rolled back tax rates and capped them at 1% of market value, and also really significantly said that future tax increases on all levels really would have to be approved by a two-thirds majority. So that makes it very difficult, and has historically, even in Sacramento, made it difficult to pass tax increases when you need a two-thirds majority. So the whole focus of school financing shifted to the state at that point. And Prop 13 cost the state overnight a quarter of its budget, which was then $7 billion, just by the rollback of tax rates to the earlier years. And then, of course, you know, limited its ability to raise taxes going forward, which was the intent of the people who put it on the ballot. It's not altogether clear that people who voted for it were supporting these kinds of cuts in public services that ensued. A lot of people believe that, you know, there was a big surplus in Sacramento at that point, the state wasted money. There would be ways to fund the services that they wanted without the exorbitant, you know, property tax rates that they felt were pushing them out of their homes. It just completely sort of changed the game, and it did that affected. We're still living with many of the intentional and unintended consequences of Prop 13 today.
And we should note that those of us who live in California are going to be voting on a split roll Prop 13 tax split, basically. It's going to head, it'll be on the ballot next year. It'll leave taxes for homes the same, but it would give the state authority to begin taxing businesses. And the California Schools and Local Communities Funding Act say that if it passes, it'll restore over $11 billion a year for services like schools and community colleges. So this is very significant, Miriam.
There's going to be a big debate over this for the next, you know, almost 2 years until it's on the ballot, for sure. And it also serves in some ways as leverage in Sacramento to try to restructure the tax system in some ways, which has been kind of an ongoing battle. You know, we in California are very, very dependent on the top income earners. An enormous percentage of the state budget right now comes from the top 1% and from capital gains, and that makes it subject to enormous sort of fluctuations, and that's why we've had the kinds of ups and downs in the past that we have. So there's been a lot of talk about trying to address that, but that's a very difficult, thorny subject. The fact that the initiative is on the ballot is going to really force that discussion and those negotiations, because right now, and this changed relatively recently, it is possible to pull an initiative from the ballot once it qualifies if the sponsors decide that they are satisfied with action that the legislature and the governor have taken and that the initiative is no longer needed. So we now have an initiative process that in some ways works kind of as a club. So, you know, either you figure out something to do between now and then, or this is going to be on the ballot. And in many cases, you have constituencies like the business community in this case who might feel that they could negotiate something that would be preferable to the initiative. So I think we're going to see a lot of discussion about Prop 13 and its consequences and the split roll over the next year and a half.
Miriam Powell is an award-winning reporter. She wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called What's Really at Stake in the Los Angeles Teacher Strike. It is day five of the strike. 30,000 teachers are striking for a higher wage, smaller class sizes, and more funding for counselors, nurses, and librarians. And if you have any comments or questions about this, what are your thoughts about the media coverage that this strike is getting? Do you think reporters are connecting the dots between various strikes across the country? West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, so many teachers across the country are either planning to strike or have already went on strike. And just what about the details, the poverty, the charter schools, just the shift that we have seen between public schools and charter schools? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. In your piece, Miriam, you report that charter schools enroll more than 112,000 students, almost one-fifth of all K-12 students. They take their state aid with them, siphoning off $600 million a year just from this district. 224 independent charters operate free from many regulations. One parent told the LA Times that public schools are expected to support special needs students, but without the resources. For me, the problem is the privatization of charter schools and the large class sizes. I want smaller class sizes for my kids. That was a parent talking to the LA Times. Miriam, what are your thoughts overall about media coverage of charter schools and how they have impacted public school finances?
It's such a complicated issue. Charter schools began, California is one of the first states to authorize charter schools back in 1992. And that initial legislation, charter schools were viewed as a sort of experimental thing that might, you know, a way to pioneer different tactics that might work, be then used in the general school system. The charters were capped at 100 in the whole state because no one envisioned that they would become the kind of huge industry that they've become, not only in California but across the country. So, you know, and the cap ultimately was lifted, and we have far more charter schools than that. There, you know, some charter schools are terrific. They are run the gamut, but the basic issue here is that there are a cadre of, you know, very wealthy business people and philanthropists in Los Angeles in particular, but in California in general, who have pushed the charter school agenda and believe that charter schools are the solution, and that is viewed, you know, in many ways as a way of privatizing the public school system in ways similar to what happened, for example, in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. There are multiple issues in terms of the charter school's role in Los Angeles, but it becomes, as I said in the piece, kind of a vicious cycle, because the worse the public schools get, the easier it is for charter schools to, you know, essentially sort of pick off and recruit parents by promising them smaller classes and other things that the traditional schools are not providing, and then you have more parents drained out of the main school. We also have a law in California that requires school districts to provide space for charter schools when it is available, and you get then this phenomenon that's called co-location, where you have a charter school in the same building as a traditional school, but operating under these very completely different rules, non-union teachers, different, you know, class sizes, and so on. And that's also crowding out, in some senses, the space that's available for the traditional schools. So there's a lot of tension between them and a lot of issues about the money that is being siphoned off to the charter schools. But in many ways, the larger issue is just the saturation. So there is no limit. The district has to approve charters regardless of what their impact might be on a community or a geographic area or the finances of the district. And there was an editorial in the Los Angeles Times this week that cited statistics about the degree to which charter schools in LA are beginning to have to compete for the same students, and one of the more highly regarded charter groups was saying that they just barely filled all of their slots this year, and that was by heavily marketing. So again, you're also getting a parent group that is the most engaged. There are the parents who really want the best education for their kids and have the time and the energy to research those questions, which again is sort of leaves the traditional schools in a much tougher position.
What are your thoughts about media coverage of the power of charter school lobbying? In your piece, you write that last year, charter school lobbies spent $54 million on losing candidates for governor and state superintendent of education, but in Los Angeles, they had more success. After his plan to move half of the LA district students into charter schools failed to get traction, the billionaire and charter school supporter Eli Broad and a group of allies spent about $10 million in 2017 to win a majority on the school board. And Capital in Maine, a great independent site that does reporting mm-hmm. on California politics, they had a piece called Reed Hastings, Netflix CEO Goes Nuclear on Public Schools. And they report that Reed Hastings has donated about $9 million to an independent committee of EdVoice, which is backing pro-charter candidate Marshall Tuck for state superintendent. This was last year. First off, Miriam, what do you think about media coverage of just the power of the charter school lobbies and these very wealthy funders?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And they have spent millions on state legislative races also, because obviously there's a lot at stake for them in Sacramento right now with proposals to increase transparency and regulation on charter schools. So those numbers are not even counting. I mean, for several different cycles now, they have spent a lot on certain legislative races in order to try to get candidates who are sympathetic to them. You know, I think like so many things these days and in times of shrinking resources for local journalism, it hasn't gotten as much attention as it should. They clearly are a really powerful force. And in Los Angeles, there's a special election that could sort of tip the balance of the school board that's coming up in March, because there's a vacancy now. That election that you referred to, where they spent $10 million, which and then the union on the other side spent, I don't remember exactly how much, not nearly as much, but it became the most expensive school board race, I think, in the country, and was covered as such by the Times. But the candidate who they got elected, school board president, who was himself a charter school founder, was forced to resign after he was indicted for campaign funding improprieties. There's actually a good piece on In These Times that just posted today, I think, that sort of gives a lot of the background of this. So anyway, there is an opening on the board, and there's going to be a sort of renewed battle over that. I think there's so many issues that deserve more coverage, and also, people should be seeing a much more nuanced coverage of charter schools. What are they? What are the ranges? What are the different types? There are for-profit charter schools. There are these big companies that come in and do them, and then there are individuals who start their own charters, which are very different in nature. So there's a lot there that could be sort of richly covered. I would say that I would give a plug for EdSource, which is a website that mm-hmm. covers education issues, and I think does a really terrific job on analyzing a lot of this.
Miriam, what do millionaires like Eli Broad and Netflix CEO Reed Hastings want for their money? Why are they spending so much money on charter schools?
That's a really good question. That would be a good story that I haven't really seen them discussing that. I think they see that as part of their philanthropic vision, that they are convinced that this is a better way to educate students. That, you know, in New York City, we saw huge battles over this in earlier years. Michael Bloomberg, who was the mayor for many years in New York City and also, you know, a wealthy philanthropist, has also been a backer of this and tried in New York to push a similar agenda with very mixed results.
We have an email from a listener who says, in San Francisco, class sizes in elementary and middle schools and in some high school classes are capped. In grades K through 3, for example, it's capped at 20 students. I keep hearing that LA class sizes are enormous. Mm-hmm. Also in San Francisco, every charter school contract must be reviewed and approved by the school board every 2 or 3 years, and they're not always approved. Does this happen in Los Angeles?
So that's a great question, and class size is a huge issue in this strike, so I'm really glad we got that got brought up. There is a it's called Section 1.5 in the contract that is the current, the expired contract in L.A. that essentially sets some targets for class size but allows the district to waive them when they determine that there is a sort of fiscal need to do so. So the class sizes are really high, and they get higher and higher, and we're just seeing stories over and over now about high school classes that have 45 kids in them, that are AP classes, that are English writing classes, and some very, I think, moving stories from teachers who talk about what it's like if you have 4 periods of, you know, English class with 45 kids in them, and it's just impossible. There are also students, a lot of students who've also spoken out on this and talked about being in classrooms where they have to sit on the floor or they have to get to class early enough to get a seat. So I think that the class size is a huge issue.
Well, thank you for that email. The other fact, and we talked about this briefly because it's connected to Prop 13, is that California ranks so low in average per pupil spending, roughly half the amount spent in New York. We've done a lot of shows about very low spending on education, very high spending on prisons. And Will Bunch, who writes a column out of Philadelphia, he's been closely following the showdown. And he said one of the questions raised by the teacher strike is why does California, a very blue state, spend like a red state when it comes to education? So we talked about Prop 13. Is there anything else that we need to focus on?
Well, it's a terrific column by Will, who is a former colleague of mine at Newsday. So I was really happy to see that. I think that the column is worth reading and referring to. There has been a general. I think that the white flight out of school districts like Los Angeles has also, which dates back to the busing fights of the late 1970s, I think has sort of also set the stage for this in some ways, because it led, you know, later on to a number of other sort of racially tinged propositions, and most famously Prop 187 in 1994. So you had for many years a real growing divide between the people who voted and who made the decisions about, you know, either directly or indirectly through their choices of elected officials, who made decisions about what sort of taxation they wanted to support, and on the other hand, the population that was availing themselves of those public services, like the schools. And I think one of the things that's sort of a hopeful sign in recent years is we've seen a shift in that, and there is a greater alignment as the demographics of California have changed towards the people who have a stake in those services also being part of the electorate and voting and exercising power either directly or indirectly. So I think that one of the reasons that the support for public services like education eroded to the extent that it did is that you had that growing gap between people who voted and people who used services. And some of that was racial and some of that was class and so forth, but it was very real.
And to that point, it's kind of connected. What's been amazing about all of these teacher strikes is to see teachers go on social media to tell their own stories. I think it was Oklahoma or West Virginia where we saw photos of chairs that were completely broken in classrooms. Mm-hmm. We saw textbooks that were ripped. I mean, the teachers in many ways are now able to tell their own stories. Same with the students. How do you think that affects the media coverage?
I think that's been a big deal. And I think one of the real successes of this strike from the point of view of the union is that they have been able to define a narrative that changes the story from this is about greedy teachers who want more money and have great benefits already and have great pensions. This is just about them wanting to enrich themselves, two, this is about the conditions in the schools and about the students. And I think they've been very effective through social media in particular. It's very interesting to see the role that social media plays in a strike like this. I mean, we haven't had that opportunity, and that would be a great story for someone. It's a great case study in the use of social media to see, as you say, I mean, the same thing here, the textbooks, the holes in the textbooks, the overcrowded classrooms, and mm-hmm. so forth. I think that they've been very effective in showing that, and then it becomes very hard for anyone to say that they support that. And then the next question, of course, which is much harder, is what do you do about that? But I think that the narrative has very much changed in a way that forces people to sort of recognize what's going on in the classrooms.
Yeah, it's such a great point. It drastically has changed. Where do you see this going, Maryam? I mean, I'm really glad that some media outlets are pointing out that we're talking now about a democratic state, a very blue state, fifth largest economy in the world. The Democrats have a supermajority in Sacramento. Where do you see this going?
You're asking for a crystal ball here. I don't know. I mean, that's the really hard question, is what does this translate into? And I think we'll have a better sense when we see how this ends. They are in sort of round-the-clock negotiations again. I think everyone wants to end the strike in some way. But it's being looked at, you know, as you pointed out, there are wildcat strikes in Oakland today. Oakland is in the process of, you know, moving towards fact-finding that could lead to a strike in February. We also haven't touched on the very real financial issues for school districts that deal with their pension commitments as well, that are sort of ballooning now because of underfunding in earlier years. Again, another factor in all of this was the Great Recession in 2007, 8, 9, 10, which led to a lot of cuts that we're just kind of making up for now in some ways. So the state has a big surplus right now that mm-hmm. could evaporate very quickly. There are going to be a lot of demands on that. I think we'll see. I think that there is a mood to do something about this, and I think that the proposition that you mentioned on the 2020 ballot is going to be a piece of all this. But, you know, none of this is going to change overnight. LAUSD has been a very troubled district for many, many years, even before the charter movement took off to the extent it has. And in some ways, you know, it's the troubles of the district led to the charter movement. So to really change things is going to take a while and require a long-term investment. And I think we're going to find out whether people are prepared to make that now or not.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. Maryam Powell is an award-winning reporter. Her New York Times op-ed is What's Really at Stake in the Los Angeles Teachers Strike. Maryam, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Thank you. We should also mention 80% of kids in LA are living in poverty. 17,000 students are homeless. We will also do a show about that in the future. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.